Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river, do we recreate ourselves? What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Char and Trev, who came up with this idea. Hey, John Fuller. Good morning and welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Tom. Good to be here.
Hey, thank you just so much for doing what you do. And today's topic is about your new book, 30 Days Below the Rim. But before we get into the book, I just want to let you know how impressed I am with the rain gauges that you and your company have scattered all across the San Francisco peaks. When the monsoons are pounding on the peaks, I can look and see, hey, there's 3 inches of rain that's just fallen in our watershed, and get ready for a flash flood sort of stuff. Can you tell me, John, a little bit about how you got into water and water hydrology?
Great question, Tom. You know, there has been a river running through my life since I was a little boy. My mother was forever telling me to get out of the ditch in the front of our house and live next to a highway, and I'd be in there building little dams out of dirt and gravel and watching them fail, and then putting little boats I'd made in my dad's wood shop and floating them down the river and doing all those kinds of things. And she'd, John, get out of the river, it's dangerous. And they'd climb out, and I'd go back as soon as she was.
When did you learn to swim?
Yeah, it wasn't that big a ditch. It was a couple of inches deep. And, but there was a creek up the road, Rainbow Creek, that we used to go to in this place we lived outside of Syracuse in upstate New York. But same thing, playing that creek all day long every time I was out of school. Yeah, so always with water. My family had a canoe, and we'd take that canoe out mostly on like little ponds and lakes in upstate New York. And then as I got a little older, junior high, we'd start taking out on our own because, man, I wanted to be in the back. I wanted to be steering.
Cool.
And I wanted to go places. So always been interested in water and moving water in particular. And then I came to graduate school in the 80s in Tucson, University of Arizona, and started studying flood hydrology with Vic Baker. And
Baker?
I know he's done some Grand Canyon work that you've...
He's brilliant. I mean, he's just a brilliant guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a good guy. He was a good advisor, and we got along well, and he had a good group of students. So we got out and started looking at Arizona rivers, and particularly in their flood histories.
Wow.
And so that's where I kind of got my professional start. And I went from graduate school to working at the Pima County Flood Control District, and was doing a lot of flood planning work and stream work down there in Pima County in southern Arizona. And one of the things they did was they had a big, extensive flood warning network. And one of my good friends, Brian Eiserman, worked in that industry. Yeah, that was kind of his specialty down there. And then he came to work for me when I started my own consulting firm in 1995. He was the first employee I had a couple of years later. And he brought that flood warning work with him. So we've been doing flood warning networks all across Arizona and into the adjacent states a little bit as well. So these gauges that are up around the San Francisco peaks, I didn't personally install them or maintain them, but the guys that worked at my company did and have done a lot of flood work there, starting primarily after the Schultz fire.
Yes.
Monitoring what happens on these watersheds that previously were forested and covered with inches of duff, feet of duff, and rainfall absorbing material. And when that goes, well, you know, from where you live and around town there, it creates an entirely different flood situation.
Oh, absolutely. So, absolutely. That's what post-fire flooding is all about.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that. We kind of drifted into that, and it's been an interesting market. And every once in a while, I'll bump into somebody and say my name, and they go, oh, like the flood guy.
Yeah.
And you know, first thing I do in the morning is I check your website for the gauges, what's going on. I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah. Not how I start my day, but it's apparently it's a nice service for a lot of people.
It is. It really is. And thank you for doing that. Well, it's a life-saving thing. Yeah. So very fun. But 30 Days Below the Rim is not your first book. What else have you written?
So I have a number of books, but you know, I've been writing a long time, and in my career as a consultant, I wrote a lot of reports and some chapters of textbooks and that sort of thing. Typically my reports are book length, but they sit on a shelf in an agency or whatnot.
Right.
Good stuff, but a limited audience. But I've always been a blogger as well, so I blogged my long hikes on trailjournals.com, and then I got on a curated site, been blogging more recently on the Trek. And on that one, I blog under my name, like trail name, which is The Incident.
Cool.
So I've been writing a long time. And one of the things I like to read is other people's trail journals and their adventure logs, whether it be like a 1849er coming west and who built a boat and floated down the Lower Gila, or you know, those kinds of things, or George Flavel going through the Grand Canyon, was it 1894 or 96 or whatever it was?
Yeah, six.
Those kinds of things have just always fascinated me. So I started writing that. And in 2017, I took a trip down the Verde River from its headwaters to where it flows into the Salt, and was a solo canoe trip, and had a journal that I kept while I was there. And got to the end, said, "Well, do I do this?" And you know, it doesn't really fit on a hiking blog post, or and decided that you know, maybe this could be a book, and started writing about the Verde. And so the canoe trip itself is kind of the backbone of that book, but it's about the Verde and its history and its future, and you know, can we save the Verde, that sort of thing.
And that book's called The Verde River Elegy.
Verde River Elegy, Battle to the River's End.
Lovely, yes. Yeah, lovely book.
I had a couple of chapters done and sent it up to a small publishing house in Flagstaff.
Oh, those poor Temple people.
Press. And they were very encouraging and said, "Hey, this is something you got some editing to do, but this is something." So we went through that and I published that. And then a couple of years after that, I did another long canoe trip on the Gila River from its headwaters down to its where it sort of flows into the Colorado River now. And that's Gila River Elegy.
And the Gila River Elegy included a helicopter extraction of your canoe out of a tamarisk jungle. I mean, it's just like, what?
That was a not very successful start to that trip. It just happened to be a flow, and I misjudged how fast Painted Rock Reservoir would have filled and how much water infiltrated between the gauge at Gillespie Dam and the reservoir, and it lost. It was 1600 CFS at the Gillespie, and 40 miles downstream, it was gone. There was nothing left, and so I was stuck, and I couldn't go back, and I couldn't go sideways, and I got out, but I had to leave the boat behind, and the only way to get the boat was to helicopter it out. So I don't recommend that, but that's what I did, and the boat was still intact enough that I took it down the rest of the river.
And one of the things about Gila River Elegy I was stunned to read is how much that river, how soon that river is dewatered off for agriculture, and your journey down the Gila was done by bicycle. And I was like, oh my gosh, what have we done here?
Well, you know, that's also the Colorado, and it happens, it has a longer run, but eventually, you know, the water's taken out for irrigation. And
yeah.
And that so many Western rivers have gone that. But for me personally, having started in the headwaters and floated through these pristine wilderness areas and, you know, all through a lot of agricultural areas that are, you know, everybody's got their little straw taking sips out of it.
Yep.
But then you get to the Ashurst Hayden Band near Florence and kind of clunk into this steel wall of flashing that puts everything into the diversion there, and the river's dry and you're standing on one side of it. You know, you've got ducks swimming next to you and heron flowing upstream on the other side. It's a desert.
It's dry.
Gravel
it's
mines and
totally dry. It's yeah, gravel mines.
Dry.
Yeah.
And you're only at, what's that, mile 320 or something like that. So you still got another 300 miles of river path, parts of which are wet, but most of which is dry.
Yeah.
So I switched to my mountain bike and since I couldn't follow the river, I followed the water and rode along the canals wherever they existed and worked my way down to Yuma.
And then you've got a book about some river history in Arizona.
Yeah, so one of the things that, that this river that's been running through my life is in the 90s, I started a project for the state of Arizona, for the state land department, looking at the navigability of streams in Arizona. And that has to do with, in part, what their condition is today, but mostly into what the condition of those rivers, were they boatable around the time of statehood or before. So I started doing historical research into, you know, who was using boats, on what rivers and where were they using, what kinds of boats, and what are the, were they successful trips, or, you know, the people got out there and found there wasn't water. What was the, what were those stories? And so I started collecting those stories, some of which are just absolutely fascinating. So I think it was my fourth or fifth book was about the accounts that happened prior to Arizona becoming a territory. So the beaver trappers, some accounts of the first people that were out using the boats, primarily on the Colorado Lower Gila, the 49ers who came through, the Army of the West that came through the Mexican-American War. All of them had some encounters with boats, some successful, some not. Great stories. And I'm currently working on a book that will be the territorial period. And I've got over 100 stories of people using different kinds of boats. These are all accounts that happen on rivers, except for the Colorado through Grand Canyon. I get people like you and others who have, that's that your area of expertise. And that's
pounded that to death. So this is great. Territorial Arizona boating. I'm like, wait a minute, it's a desert. There's cowboys crawling around on hands and knees with empty canteens and,
well, there was
and
that,
vultures yeah. circling over their head, you know.
Yeah, but there's some people that are out and they built boats and they floated down the rivers. And
did they ever?
They did, yeah. And so they were out there. When there's water in Arizona, people are going to go use it. So until the water's all in the canals. And
exactly.
And then things become different. So
yes, they do. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the territorial book. That sounds awesome. Yeah. But here today, we are talking about your latest book, 30 Days Below the Rim. And, you know, the title kind of speaks for itself. Right away, I'm thinking, oh, this is a Grand Canyon winter river trip, because you can only do a 30-day trip, which is a 29-night. On the 30th day, you've got to leave the park and get to the ramp. That's an interesting title. And what does that title mean to you? I know what it means to me. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, well, I like to title my book so that you look at the title and you go, I think I know what that book's about. So I'm glad to hear you say that you create an image in your mind of what this was going to be about. And I think because of your experience with the Grand Canyon, you may see into some subtleties into there that others who are less familiar may not. So the full title is 30 Days Below the Rim, a Grand Canyon whitewater rafting adventure. So 30 days, like you hit on that exactly, that's the maximum number of days you can squeeze out of a permit to run through Grand Canyon, below the rim. So the rim is the rim of the Grand Canyon. If you've been to the top and visited the south or north rim, you stand up there and you look down into this vast expanse. Well, that's, in my mind, that's the tourist zone, all the area above the rim. Below the rim is where the adventure happens. Whether you're walking or boating, in my mind, that's where the good stuff happens. And so because of that good stuff, you want to stay the maximum number of days down there that you possibly can.
Exactly.
And then the Great Grand Canyon Whitewater Rafting Adventure part, it is a book that's about a private whitewater rafting trip through Grand Canyon, which is for every boater I know, that's on your bucket list. It's something you want to do once. And once you've done it once, you're already thinking about the next time.
And I've got to ask you, because a lot of people are like, no, I'm not interested in 30 days in the winter. It's cold, dark. I 30 days, 30 days without a shower. As one person we ran into at the end of a 30-day trip, they had flown in by helicopter to the helipads way out there by Burnt Springs. And we pulled over and we're talking with them. And when they found out what we were doing, this person just shouted right out. Right in our faces, 30 days without a shower. We were like, looked at each other. What are we? Do we smell bad?
Hey, if they gave me a permit for 60 days, I'd go 60 days without a shower.
Oh, yeah. Sign me up.
But yeah, so my first trip was a 14 or 16 day trip in summer.
Okay.
And so I've done summer, I've done spring, I've not done a fall trip, which I would like to do at some point. But most of my trips have been winter trips. After that first summer trip, it's so hot. And also in the summer, you have the commercial trips running through, and you have more private trips. So it's a busier river. The weather, you know, it's Arizona weather. Conversely, when you're taking a winter trip in Grand Canyon in Arizona, it's an Arizona winter. Now, granted, you're a little higher than you are for most of the places below the rim, but I like to think of a March trip as like a spring training weather. You know, you're going to have days that are warm in the afternoon and cold at night. Every once in a while, you know, you'll get some nasty cold weather, again, a cold snap, and we've paddled in snow before down there. I've seen nankweep in the snow, which is just awesome.
Beautiful.
You know, when they're there. But you also get spring. So you get spring in the desert and blossoms and whatnot. And to me, those winter trips, because of the extra days, they make it all worthwhile. So
you can trust. I don't tell anybody on this podcast. I don't want people to know, but it's like I equate it to living on the streets of Phoenix in the winter.
Yeah.
Except for a lot better. In your tent, yeah, we got a lot of food and friends.
Yeah, that's the question I get is, you know, well, how do you pack enough food? Well, you know, you got these big rafts and they can carry a lot of stuff. And on a raft trip, you're just never, it's luxury in a way. If you come from a backpacking or a canoeing background, the amount of stuff you can bring with you in a raft or a dory trip or whatnot is just incredible. So you're not going to be hungry and you're not going to be that uncomfortable.
It's 30 days of car camping and how much stuff. Yeah, you can get a lot of junk in there. So you've been on the river in the winter, and were you writing about a particular river trip that you experienced that to pull this trip together?
So I've launched from Lee Surrey 9 times, been taken out of various places, either Diamond or Pierce. And I'm a journaler, as I mentioned before. So I've got journals full of trip stories and accounts, and here's what we did, and this is what happened to us. There's a lot of good stories in there. So 30 Days Below the Rim is a compilation of all those trips, the best and some of the worst parts of them, and experiences that happened on one trip and experiences of other trips. There's probably one trip that has more of it than others. It was an exemplary trip. But there's a little bit of drawing in from lots of different places. Some of my characters are composites of people I met. Some are a little more directly. There's a few people that said, hey, you can use my name. I'd like you to use my name. So I kept those people's names where they wanted. And other people have changed names and brought in characteristics of other people to just to improve the narrative and just to expand the kinds of things that happen when you're in Grand Canyon. Because some trips are different than other trips.
Yeah, absolutely. And in reading your book, and I got to tell you, I enjoy your writing. I enjoyed this book very much. But right away, it didn't take me long, even before the trip started, to go, uh-oh. But these things happen. And I wanted to ask you as a writer, I guess, you know, people like strife, trauma. You know, the best trips I've ever had have no strife, no trauma. I mean, we're all singing at night, and we're singing as we go down the river during the day, and we're hiking our little feet off, except for the smart people who stay in camp. Nobody gets hurt. There's no flips. There's no carnage. It's just boringly beautiful. Mm-hmm. But you didn't write about that.
Yeah. I did write about some of that. There's a lot in the book where I'm having that kind of experience, joy and
But you're having to work at it.
In this particular trip that I'm describing, well, you know, when you write a book, people want to see some struggle and they want to see some resolution.
That's right. And you did well.
That's a good narrative to have. In some ways, it's a little boring to say, I went down there and everything went great. And I've had trips where most everything went great. There's always a little something that happens. But I felt like what happened on this trip that I'm telling the story about was bigger than the canyon. So we're struggling with each other on this trip. There are some people that didn't get along, and our trip leader in particular was not the best. And he brought on some strife, brought some things into the canyon that were happening in the outside world that created some conflict. But I felt like we were able eventually to work to a peace solution, to find our own peace, to find our own space that we could be ourselves, let other people be themselves, and find some unity and whatnot. So I think there's a greater message there. That's something that's also been on my mind a lot. And part of one of the reasons that I wrote this book was that I wanted to say something about the current state of the world right now that I think the Canyon experience can bring some wisdom to.
Yeah. It's funny when I think about what's happening on river trips, there is a designated permit holder, mm-hmm. a person who is responsible for the group when standing in front of a judge, if there's a citation issued.
Right.
And the Park Service has set up a system where the person who gets that permit, they get a leg up if they haven't been in the canyon for at least 5 years. They get five extra points in the lottery. So right away, you've got a system that's benefiting a permit holder who knows the canyon from five or more years ago, if that.
Yeah.
So in order to kind of offset that, they've got a qualified boat operator, someone who's been on whitewater rivers, in theory has some experience in big water and knows how to deal with hydraulics and eddies from hell, excuse my language, and wind and weather and whatever. So now we have two people, and oftentimes the qualified boat operator can be called the trip leader can hijack the trip.
Yeah, that's kind of what we had in the situation in the story that I'm writing about. There was a person who won the permit, so she's the permit holder, and she had never been down before. So, and she had some boating experience in a kayak, not in a raft. So she went to a friend of hers, who was a very experienced boater, had been down the canyon a number of times, and had proved himself as a trip leader, and said, "Could you be my trip leader or my qualified operator?" And he agreed. But at the last minute, he had to drop out because of a work situation. So they went to another person who was also an experienced boater that she didn't know well, that the person who had been going to lead the trip knew a little bit and said, "Well, he's experienced. He could probably do a good job." So they brought him in kind of at the last minute. And she had never boated with him. Lots of us had never boated with him. And he turned out to not be the best leader. He had some issues there. But you're right. That is the system. So it's easier for inexperienced people to get a permit, and they need to seek out someone to help them get down the river. And if they don't know somebody who is good at that sort of thing or good at leading a group, then you can have some issues.
And the Grand Canyon is such an amazing place. You're only allowed one trip a year. If you're lucky, you can do that, but most people aren't that lucky. And it's all about the people. It's not the rapids, it's not the rattlesnakes or the scorpions. And your book gets that across so clearly.
Yeah, like if I give a book talk and I ask people, envision yourself rafting Grand Canyon. What do you see? And people who haven't been before almost always have a picture in their mind of blasting through this big Grand Canyon 9 rapid, water splashing everywhere and hanging on for dear life. And that's what they think. Well, the rapids are about 5% of the river. Most of the time you're on current and it's relatively flat water, but you're floating and you're kind of looking up. And even the amount of time you're on the water, particularly on a winter trip where you're down there for 24 to 30 days, most of the time you're spent hiking or in camp. You're really not on the river more than anything else. So that image of what people have in their head is not what the trip is about. And the whole time you're with this same group of, either 2 to 16 people, and that's your world for a month. And if these people don't get along, it can be a long month. And you have to really work at some relationships. And other times, like you said, there's groups you get down there and it's just kumbaya every night. People get along and it's laughter and stories and adventure and it's a lot of fun, but not always.
You've just reminded me one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in Grand Canyon. We had a really nice 30-day trip. Really good. We came around the corner to the Pierce Ferry ramp. So this is going to be sometime after 2009. And there was a trip ahead of us and we had never seen them. I mean, they must've just been just hours ahead of us day after day after day. We never saw them. And we pulled up and I looked and I'm just like, wait a minute, these people are all wearing garlands and I'm looking at fresh flowers, wow. draped around their necks, you know, and like Hawaiian leis, you know. So I get out of my boat and I walk up to the first person wearing this garment and I say, "Hi, you know, it's good to see you guys. Well, we didn't see you. We were right behind you most of the whole trip for a month. That's amazing. I'm, you know, unless I don't know how, well, whatever. But if you don't mind my asking, you're wearing garlands. What's going on?" And the guy looked at me and he said, "We can't explain it. We've had the best trip of our lives. We called out to a florist in Vegas and had them make these and deliver them to us here at the ramp." but your book, 30 Days Below the Rim, is not that. This is not a garland trip.
Yeah.
So in thinking about that, the extremes between the good and the bad, because I agree with you 100% that it is all about the people. What makes a good passenger? What makes a good permit holder? What makes a good qualified boat operator?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no one answer to any of those questions. It's going to depend on the group and their dynamics. You know, is this a bunch of newbies, or is this people that have been down 10 times before? Is it people that want to be led, or people that want to lead? There's lots of different ways to think of that. For me personally, a good passenger is somebody who never asks to take over the oars.
Well, wait a minute. That's for you personally, because excuse my language, John. You're an oar hog. You get out the super glue at least, Ferry. You glue your oar grips to your gloves, and then your hands fit in there, and that's where they stay the entire trip.
Yeah, I always tell people I come to row, and I've had people climb in and say, "Well, I'm really looking forward to learning to row," and I said, "Well, I'll teach you everything I know, but you're not going to actually do any unless you climb in another boat."
A good passenger doesn't ask to row. Okay, yeah, John Fuller isn't there.
Which is not entirely true, but I do. I just, pulling on the oars is my happy place. I could do it all day, every day. So for me, that makes a good passenger. But other than that, you know, my most common passenger is my wife, and she sits up front and we talk, and we just talk and talk. So I like having good conversations as I go along, but we also have times where we're just quietly absorbing everything that's going on around us, all the things that we're seeing. And another thing about a good passenger is, you know, they're spotting things, not only just, "Hey, there's a rock ahead," or something like that, but, "Hey, there's a bighorn sheep," and, "Oh, look at that osprey, just caught a fish." And, you know, they're calling things out because I'm looking at the river and trying to read water and whatnot, and have less time to steer up. So that's a good thing about a passenger. You know, and they're handling things, helping to load the raft. That's a big thing in a passenger. You know, I'm not your concierge here. We're partners in this trip. We have our roles and whatnot. You know, handling the tie line, things like that. They're good in the passenger. Good trip leaders. To me, a good trip leader reads their group. They're doing what they need to do for that group. And like I say, they may be different for a group of newbies compared to a group of experts. So newbies would be like, "Show us the good stuff. We want to do the good hikes. We want to see the things we've read about or seen online. We want to see those things, and just tell us how to get there. We get to a rapid, I don't know how to do this one. Show me a good line. Show me what I'm looking at. Help me to understand how to get through this." But with a group of experienced people, I think the trip leader's role is more to, "Okay, group, what would we like to do today, over the next week, over the next 3-4 weeks? How is this going to work together?" You know, to build consensus on those things, to listen to everybody. And not everybody's going to get what everybody wants on every day. So it's, "I'm sorry, today we're going to have to skip that hike, but tomorrow you wanted to do this thing. We'll make sure you get that. Is that okay?" And like, "No, I really want this thing." "Okay, well, let's talk to the other person. You know, maybe we'll give you your thing today, and tomorrow they'll get their thing, or a week from now they'll get their thing," or some people, you know, that sort of thing. Just balancing out. Also, a trip leader, you know, if people are having some issues personality-wise, figuring out ways to mediate between that. It's like, "How can I help you with this?" "Well, this person, they're always doing this. You know, they rush me when I'm on the groover," or whatever it is. And you're like, "Okay, well, let's talk about that." And you know, to work things out. And then there's just some logistic things about planning the trip. Communicating to everybody beforehand, I think, is also a big one. Saying, "Okay, this is the kind of trip we have. We're on a hiking trip, folks. So we're going to push down the river. We're going to get to our sites. We're going to do the hikes. That's what we're all about." other people are like, no, we're a floating trip. We're not going to push the oars at all. We're going to take all the time we possibly can floating the river, and we're going to pull in, and other people are about the camps. You know, we're going to get these specific camps, and we're going to engineer our trip that way. So the trip leader communicates between everybody, this is the kind of trip we're going to do. We've all said this is what we're going to get. So people know before they go kind of what to expect. The trip leaders are good listeners. Listen first, speak later, and that sort of thing. What else? They're going to need a thick skin. You know, it's not an easy job. People sometimes bark about how things are going, and it's the trip leader's fault. So you kind of have to put up with some kvetching and whatnot.
And what about permit holder?
The permit holder, they got to be lucky and get one of those things, which I have not been. I've done it. You know, I got when we converted from the old system to the new system, mm-hmm. back in the 2010s, whenever that was.
2006, the lottery started. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a bunch. I had a bunch of points. So in 2014, I had a bunch of that stuff. We and another guy teamed up, and we got a. That's how we got that summer trip.
Oh, how did that work out?
In what sense?
Well, so what I've heard anecdotally, you know, for a while, the park was taking people on the waiting list and trying to pair them up. So, you know, you can bring you and your seven friends, and I'll bring me and my seven friends, and we'll all have a good time.
You know, in our case, it was a friend of mine.
Okay.
So we both had, when we boated together a lot. So that trip was great. We got along really well. And
super.
And it was a group of people we mostly knew. Some of it was friends of friends, but not. Mm-hmm. But we had a good time. Yeah. So the permit holder, it kind of depends on, like in our case, in the trip in 30 days, she'd never been before. So she was looking for guidance, someone to help me through this. Midway through the trip, she realized that Bill, our trip leader, really didn't have great trip leading skills. And so she started to take control of some of those things and say, no, Bill, this is how it's going to go. I'm going to put my foot down here. And sometimes the permit holder is to say, well, I've got this trump card here. This is my trip. I earned it. So I'm going to make this final decision. And I think most people kind of go, okay, that's okay. That, you know, it is, it's right. You want it. You invited us. Thank you for that. You're cashing in your thank yous to make this particular decision or whatever. So sometimes that's an important thing. I think the role of the permit holder, if you're choosing a group, is then to say, how can we put together as much of a compatible group as we possibly can? Because there are different kinds of trips. So, you know, some people, the hiking trip, like I just mentioned, other people are all about the camps, and other people are all about, they want to have, you know, the nightly, you know, costume nights and things like that. I went on one trip, they wanted to have poems every morning. And that was cool. And then other trips are like party trips and whatnot. And some people are teetotalers, and some people want to have talk politics the whole time when they're down there, or religion or whatever. And other people are like, man, I want to put that aside. I want a vacation from all that stuff.
Right.
So that's, I think, on the trip leader, as well as on the permit holder, as well as the trip leader, to kind of screen that out and say, well, this is the kind of trip that we're having. You know, we're not going to be blaring music. It's okay to sit around, have some beer and wine, whatnot, but nobody should be falling down drunk when they're on the river, or whatever the rules are going to be. Drugs, no drugs, lots of those kinds of things. So just sorting that out. And then as just a trip participant, it's kind of on you to ask the questions to find out what kind of a trip this is going to be. And am I going to enjoy this trip, or am I going to be the person I joined this trip and I'm constantly trying to tell 15 other people, no, not the kind of trip you want. It's the kind of trip I want. And that's just not going to lead to any happiness. You're not going to have a good experience for that. It's going to, you can't really ruin a Grand Canyon trip because it's Grand Canyon. It's just fantastic, but you're going to make it difficult for you and everybody else.
You know, it's funny. I've come up with a little saying, John Fuller, I want to go to hell. I want to go to hell with heavenly people because we might have a good time. We might actually see the humor in it. But if I go to heaven with hellish people, our chances of having a good time in heaven are not so great.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
And that's a dilemma. But I really like, you know, what you're saying about passengers being alert and aware and looking around. Yeah, we're in some big water. And the boat rower is trying to pay attention to the, you know, the rock ahead or the hole and off. There's a hole right there. I got to do something. The passenger can look around and say, oh, that boat behind you just lost somebody.
Yep.
So I really think that everybody on the trip, when I'm falling into the water because I'm laughing so hard and I pop up to the surface and a 12-year-old reaches out to grab me, you know, that 12-year-old is, in my eyes, the most valuable person on that trip.
Absolutely.
And they're, in quotes, a passenger. I really like the trip leader that says, look, we're going to scout. We'll scout the Perea if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll scout Badger. We'll scout Soap. We will scout everything early so that we build confidence in the people that need confidence building. The people that don't, they can run the rapid while we're watching and we can talk it through.
Right.
So, just these different things that passenger can do, the trip leader can do. The permit holder has a really hard job. Their job, you know, as you say, is to pull together people that work well together.
Yep.
And people that work well together, doesn't matter where they are, all around the world, what kind of situations, their chances of success, really good.
Yeah. 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 You know, if you've been for a long swim in cold water, particularly on a winter trip, you know, it doesn't matter who's handing you that hand. All of a sudden, all those differences and even the arguments you had in camp, it's like, I don't care who's going to pull me out of the river. I want back in the boat.
Right.
And that's kind of the attitude I think you have to have. And we kind of came to in this trip that I write about is that, you know, we are this group and this is our unit and we need to make it a place of peace and enjoyment and find the things in each other that I don't agree with everything that you are, mm-hmm. but I agree with enough. We have this river in common,
right,
and then this canyon in common. And it's really enough. You know, I thought right about the thin spidery thread that's between us. It's not much, but it's enough. It's enough.
Absolutely.
We could bring that outside the canyon as well.
Yeah.
And instead of seeing ourselves in teams of red and blue and other divisive things, which are important things, but to also see, you know, our common humanity, or we're people that we want the best for this country that we live in, or whatever place that we're in, or whatnot.
Exactly.
Just look at that, and that's enough. We did a trip. The second trip I made was in December 2016, which I think actually you were supposed to be on, but I think Hazel's dad or something had passed or was sick or something, and so you had to pull out.
That's right.
But if you recall, December 2016 was kind of a tumultuous time, with a lot of stuff going on in America because of the election that had just happened. We just said, hey, you know what? On this trip, no politics, no religion. Let's just take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people on that trip that I did not know that were friends of friends. Or that trip went great. We got along. Nobody had any of these, you know, nobody had any political arguments or anything like that, any religious arguments or whatnot. And it was a really, really nice trip. We had good hikes. You know, it was December, so we had some bad weather and things to endure. We got to the end, you know, and it had become Facebook friends after we got out. We kind of connected on that. And all of a sudden you realize, oh, people have very strong political opinions in one direction or the other. Like, we had no idea. It just wasn't that important.
Well, that's so important. I mean, when I think about the permit holder, okay, the analogy I use is an old analogy. Young kids won't get it from a series called Mission Impossible, where the permit holder gets an email from the park saying, "Hey, you've just won this permit to raft Grand Canyon. The secretary will disavow any information if things go bad, but good luck." And then what happens in the old Mission Impossible? The next thing is the Mr. Phelps is looking at people who he's going to have come on his trip. Oh yeah, I want this woman because she's really good with languages. Yeah,
right,
I want this
right.
guy because he can work a screwdriver upside down in the dark. Oh, I want this person because, and they all play well together, and the trip leader thinks about what they want with regards to music, as you say. With regard to drugs, as you say, with regards to drinking, with what kind of trip this is going to be. This is so important. That's the foundation of a good trip right there.
Yeah. And then it's on the individuals to say, okay, well, I signed up for this kind of trip, and that's what I was told was going to be, to just kind of live by those, that agreement that you made, and just say, okay, well, I'm going to put aside politics, or we're not going to get falling down drunk. whatever the things that were you'd agreed to before, and just kind of, well, we're going to live by those rules. And, you know, maybe that's not what you would originally have wanted, but you kind of agreed to it. And it just helps. It just helps when everybody pulls together like that.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, I have my opinions on this, and I want your opinions first. Can anyone boat the Grand Canyon? I mean, somebody with, you know, normal health, normal fitness.
Well, that's a great question, Tom. I would say not everyone, but almost everyone. I've certainly, if people with certain kinds of disabilities or sicknesses or illnesses, it would be very difficult for them, and it might be dangerous for them and others around them. But most people, certainly as a passenger, if you're in reasonable health, my last trip down in 2025, I brought a guy down who was 74 years old and did not walk very well. He had trouble getting in and out of the boat, and it was an enormous responsibility. So that wasn't somebody I'd met before. He got assigned to my boat at East Ferry. So that was kind of a surprise, but he made it. He did fine. He really, really enjoyed it. And we actually got to know each other over the course of, that was a 25-day trip, and those 25 days. And, you know, he did great. I don't know he'd sign up for another one, but, and he ended up being our permit holder. He wasn't planning on coming on the trip. His brother had the permit. His brother had some sort of life-threatening illness. So the Park Service will transfer it to a blood relative. So he ended up with the permit, and his coming allowed the rest of us to come. So we're all very grateful to him and helped him as much as we could. Anyways, so can anyone boat it? As a passenger, probably most people can. You know, if you want to be outdoors.
Yeah, the qualifier is you're in reasonable health, you're in reasonable fitness.
You like the water. you like being on rivers. But can you, and anyone row it? A lot more people than maybe think they can. Grand Canyon's a nice river trip because, you know, it starts out pretty mellow. So there's, you know, day one, a couple of rapids to get your attention, then a potential, I guess you could have a problem in, but most people don't. And if you have someone along who's showing you what to do, in the book I write about this guy, Tristan, who is based on a real character who had never rode a raft before at all. And we start out and he goes for the Priya and he's hitting the bank and he's getting stuck in the eddies and just doesn't have a clue. And we go through, I think it was Badger and, one of those two, I think it was Badger. He went through and he just kind of froze and he just rode the wave train and we were all going to pull out there. And he just didn't know how to pull. He didn't know how to eddy out. Didn't know how to do any of the strokes. And so the next day we put an experienced rower in with him, and he was a young guy, healthy and smart, and he picked it up. And so by the end, you know, he's talking about, I'm going to buy my own raft and where's my next trip going to be. And he learned to row. You know, he rowed all the big ones, never flipped his raft the entire trip. So it's not a bad place to learn if you have somebody who can teach and if you're capable to learn. So I think there's a lot more people that can do it. I'm not one of the people that says only people rowing down there should be people who have vast resumes of rowing. I've taken a lot of newbies down the Diamond Down Run from Diamond Creek down to Pierce Ferry and taught them the row along the way, and they've done fine. So that's my thought. Lots of people can.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I may tend to take that to a little more extreme. You mentioned, and you do mention in 30 days with Tristan, where when he's given a coach, he blossoms quickly.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm all about coaching. I'd much rather have a person on the oars who has desire, who has thirst, who wants to row.
Yep.
And if we counsel them, which either means riding in the boat with them or having, you know, someone near them that they can follow. You know, you don't put a whole line of boats together with inexperience, following inexperience. You got to put experience followed by inexperience, followed by experience, followed by inexperience. This isn't rocket science. And I, especially looking at history, you're dealing with territorial history of boating in Arizona. I mean, the territorial history of boating in Grand Canyon, the people have zero experience, zero, zero and they survived. Well, yeah, but they were hungry and blah, 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 and they smashed their thumb and yada, yada, yada. Okay, fine. Well, we've got amazing life jackets. We've got amazing gear now. This isn't rocket science.
Yeah, I was just going to say a lot depends on the boat, too. Like if you're going down in a 12-foot inflatable raft, that might not be a good first trip boat. You know, an 18-footer is a lot more forgiving. It's harder to push around, but, you know, that extra width and length saved me personally on my first trip down many times where we did not take the best lines.
Mm-hmm. But that's experience. That's how you learn.
But that's experience. You also have to kind of have that spirit of, yeah, if I flip, I'm going to swim, and that's not good. But that's just part of learning. And if, you know, if I go into a hole and get thrown out of the boat, that's part of learning. And if you have that, like, you just brush that off and go, well, I won't do that again. I hope. And what did I, or what did I do wrong? How did that happen to me?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You'll do fine. And that's how Tristan, that character, was. He was like, show me what to do. And then he would be constantly asking you questions about, what do you mean a downstream ferry? What's a downstream ferry?
Right.
I don't understand what that move is. And
you learn. And this is like how to ride a horse. Wait a minute. I got to get up there. It's a long way to the ground.
Yeah.
Get with it, get up there, and you're probably going to hit the ground. And you'll learn how not to do that. In a boat, you're gonna fall out of the boat. Okay, fine. You got your life jacket on, you better. And get back in the boat. Head out.
And having said all that, I think you also have to recognize there is some risk there, too. I mean, people do get hurt, and some people die in Grand Canyon. Some of them are rafters. You know, you're far more likely to get injured climbing in and out of your boat than you are flipping and having a bad swim. But it does happen, and you need to also, that can't terrify you. And
acknowledge that
life is like that. You know?
I can choke on my hamburger at the McDonald's.
The drive to Canyon is probably worse than the
drive across Flagstaff for an old guy like me. It's not the other guy I worry about. exactly. So the risks we take every day, go to Grand Canyon, it's just something we haven't done. It's new for us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I liked how you brought that forward. And again, I'm really into putting experience within experience and making the inexperienced people comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. In the book, Tristan Learning to Row I like that part of the story. A woman named Wren, who's also based on a character, who's just one of the best people I've met on the river. She's just like the perfect kind of river person.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets in the boat with him, and you can just see, you were just watching her explain things, and he's just absorbing it. And he goes from not being able to eddy out, losing an oar on day one, to the next day, you know, he rows to 20s and does fine.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that fast, and then, just like that. Yeah. Boom. This is good.
Yeah.
Looking through your many years of boating now, what are a couple things you want to give as advice to new boaters so that they don't have to go through such a steep learning curve?
Well, don't bite off the biggest, nastiest river on your first trip. You know, start with something to learn the strokes, just to get used. There's a muscle memory thing that comes from learning to boat. And I tell that to people all the time. It's like, you see them, they're pushing, especially when you're using an oar boat as opposed to like a paddling boat with a canoe paddle or whatever. But with an oar board, you see them like, I push on the left oar, and the oar is going backwards. Am I going right or left, or how's this doing? And wait, if I pull on it, I'm doing what? And they're just mentally just having to think each time, I want to go to the left, so which way do I pull this? And you see them kind of wiggling back and forth before they, oh, this is what I need to do. And you say, just be calm. Don't worry about it. You're getting used to it. I guarantee you that in 30 minutes, you're going to have this muscle memory.
That's right.
Or maybe it's by tomorrow. And you're not even really going to be thinking about it. You're just going to say, oh, I need to go over there. And you're doing this thing with your hands that makes the oars do what they do and the boat spinning and whatnot. And it's just very instinctive, or at least it is for most people. So start small. Pick a less challenging river to start with. Boat with experienced people, like you were just saying. That's another thing too, is I never took a rafting lesson anywhere. Well, you can do that, which is another good thing you can do. I just boated with experienced people and said, how did you get around that? You know, I went right through that big hole. How did you get around it? For the longest time, upset rapid was my nemesis. First time down, I got around on the right side. I've never done the left turn. I've always wanted to. And then every time after that, I hit the hole, and I just couldn't get in there. And I, what am I doing wrong? And I talked to the experienced boaters, and they'd suggest this and suggest that. Sometimes they were experienced, but not particularly knowledgeable what I was doing. But I got lots of hints, and eventually, you know, I can get around on the right side. And I've done that now, so I can not only look over on the left and try that run. You know,
I really love the right run. It's just, it's technical. You've got to work at it. You've got to, you know, there's a bunch of keeper rocks at the top. You got to get around, depending on the flow level. And so, it's a technical run. The left is fine too. You don't want to go too far left. You hit the wall. You got to be, you got to kind of work at it. But both ways, there's a hole down there you would like to miss. I've hit that hole straight on before.
I've hit it straight on. I've hit it sideways. I've hit it backwards. I've gotten around it a couple of times. So,
there you go.
Like I say, it's my nemesis. It shouldn't be, but it is. I don't know why.
It's a lovely place to practice your skills. So,
yeah.
What would you tell people that at least very well? No, what would you want to tell people 6 months before their trip that they may not hear before they get to Lee's Ferry?
You know, we talked about this a little before, but the trip is not all about the rapids. My first trip, it was like I had your guidebook in front of me, and I'm looking at it going, okay, how far to the next rapid? And is it bigger? Is it smaller? What's its rating? You know, what does it say about how to get around the obstacles? And I'm just all the time thinking about the rapids. You know, what's the best one? What's the good one? How many good ones do we have today? And now I'd say, I tell people, I still love the rapids, but it's a minor part of my trip. I'd see, you know, it's there's so much else. And now I really enjoy the time between the rapids, probably more than I do the rapids themselves.
So nice.
To anticipate that, most of the time on the river, you're floating on calm water, like I said before. Think about the hiking. Come prepared to hike. You know, bring good shoes and gloves. You know, the limestone doesn't tear your hands apart. I always hike with a pole and bring that along. Think about those things. And think about the creature comforts you want in camp. This is a backpacking lesson for me. From backpacking, I used to go ultralight. And I was just lying awake one night in a too tight sleeping bag on a too small pad, and I'm spending a third of my time on this trip in this tent, on this lousy pad. I need to bring some more creature comforts. And that's another one too. Then, you know, bring a book and a game and a bunch of books and a bunch of games and things you like to do, a pair of binoculars and, you know, that kind of thing, whatever it is that's going to help you enjoy all the quiet moments of the trip. And bring a journal and write down your stories.
Absolutely.
There's so many good stories. Yeah.
Gosh, it's the journals. As I'm sure you know, you find a historic journal. That's what makes us understand the stories of those who went before us is their journals.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And I've done that. On one trip I took, I think I talk about this in 30 days, I brought four or five different old journals. I can't remember which ones are they are right now, but Flavel's one of them, and one of the Cole brothers, and of course Powell. And every day, I would read what they had written about what I had just paddled or rode. And that was kind of fun to see what they mentioned and what they didn't mention. Like sometimes I think it was, what was it? Flavel maybe went through the '20s and didn't say a thing about it. and it's like, huh, that was kind of a big deal, but,
doop.
Yeah. Didn't merit a line.
I mean, he might've been busy, but
yeah.
Didn't curious. But boy, you just touched upon something that just, I was like, oh yeah, that's an important point. I always encourage people, especially on long winter trips, to make sure that their world, their tent, their sleeping bag, their sleeping pad, their snacks, their books, their music keeps them in their comfortable space so that they can close out the world. They can have their own comfortable world to themselves. And the concept of, I'm going to go minimalist with X and minimalist with Y. Gosh, on a long river trip, I'm like, wait a minute. Let's make sure you've got a good pillow. Let's make sure you've got some good books and some good snacks that you like. You like those things? Oh, my gosh, those pull my fillings off my teeth. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. Right. Go for it. Right. So that people are comfortable in their own world there. I mean, as a foundation.
I bring a stack of books and I think I'll never read all of these books. And then I've read them all and, you know, we've still got 10 days to go. And then we have a little book swap go on.
Yeah, which is great.
Trade books, and so you find some authors you wouldn't have read before, which is cool. So, yeah, you're right about that. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about them.
In a good tent. That's another lesson.
Well, I wasn't going to talk about that because I didn't want to, you know, that's a spoiler alert there for this book.
Well, let's just say, leave it as, I learned a little lesson about why you buy certain types of gear and why saving money might not be the best idea in some cases. So.
Yeah. No, this is not the place to scrimp on gear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, 30 Days Below the Rim. Where do I get this book?
Well, it's available on Amazon. If you just put in their little search bar, 30 Days Below the Rim, it does pop up. If you know me personally, you're welcome to contact me. I can get you a copy. But Amazon's
how do I contact you?
Well, I have an email address. It's J-O-N, no H in John, at jefuller.com. So it's John Fuller.
Wait a minute. Spell this out for me.
Yeah, J-O-N at jefuller.com.
That's right. Very good. Okay, got that. Yeah. So I can buy direct from you. I can get it from Amazon. Okay.
Yeah, we had some Facebook announcements a couple of days ago. And a couple of people contacted me through Facebook, and they wanted signed copies. And
cool.
Obviously, you can't buy that from Amazon. So
that's right. That's right. Are you giving any book presentations upcoming soon?
I have one at the Arizona Hydrologic Society. They asked me to come up talk in February. In September up in Flag, and trying to put something else together, and not really coming up with a good spot for it. I have a message into Brightside. I haven't heard back from them yet. But
okay.
I will come around Arizona, possibly Utah.
Arizona Hiking Shack there in Phoenix?
Yeah, I've done that before. They're good people. So
okay. That would be good. And what's ahead? What are you working on now?
So I'm working on this book about the territorial era stuff, but I've got a couple other ones that are in the hopper that have been kind of working on off and on for a few years. One's a story of John McCarty. I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy. He was Arizona's first fish and game commissioner.
Oh.
Was killed by a bear in 1902.
Oh my gosh.
And just before he went on that trip, it was a collecting. He sold animals to museums and whatnot. That's how he made their money. So as a game and fish commissioner. But he took out 5 life insurance policies. And
whoa.
And just, you know, coincidentally died a few months later. And so the insurance companies were a little skeptical, let's say. But eventually it was decided that, yes, he did die. And his wife was pregnant at the time, gave birth, and had married somebody else, had a child with him. And I think I've discovered evidence that he didn't die. He reappeared in her life in California. So I'm working on that. That's a
good story. Oh, my gosh.
And then I'm also, I think I'm rewriting a book that I had done. It's called Murder by Cannibals. It's about the story of Ariel Robinson, who was an 1890s journalist in Phoenix. And he had done some boating. That's how I came across him on Arizona rivers and whatnot. And he was supposedly murdered by the Seri on the island of Tiburon in the Sea of Cortez.
Right.
Where he had boated to with George Slovel, actually.
Right.
He was his boatmate. And Slovel's journal that he wrote, used when he took his trip, was Robinson's journal, actually. And he left on the boat when Robinson went ashore on Tiburon and supposedly was killed by Seri. So anyways, I wrote that book, and there's a lot of suspicion that Robinson faked his death. Hmm. So I've written that book. It's been out for a couple of years. I get a call a couple of weeks ago from a lady in Oklahoma who says, Ariel was my great, great uncle.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have pictures. And
oh, my gosh.
So she's got a bunch of stuff about this guy. And, you know, I wrote the book leaving it kind of as a mystery as to what happened to him. And I think between the two of us, I think we're going to work out whether he actually died or not. So I think we'll do a second edition on that one.
Lovely.
And, she's been kind of fun to talk to. She's got a lot of family history.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, that's always the best is to get the family involved and pulling out the stories and bringing out the history.
Yeah, I love what you're doing with the oral history stuff, Tom, because on the other book with John McCarty that I'm thinking about, he had his wife's, his widow's next husband. They had a child, and that child lived in Tucson, and she lived to be almost 100 years old. She passed away a year before I started working on this project.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm going through Ancestry.com, and I said, oh, there's a person in Tucson. And then come to find out that she's gone. And I just missed it. So, yeah. Had somebody interviewed somebody like there, then maybe she's got the answer.
It's the story of our lives.
Yeah.
We just weren't quick enough. So,
yeah. Anyway, so I'm working on that, and who knows what else will pop up.
Lovely. John Fuller, this has been a lovely visit. I wish you all the success with 30 Days Below the Rim. Thank you so much for talking about the ins and outs of Grand Canyon River trips, and thank you so much for writing about them so that I that's a double negative. I don't want to say that. I encourage all permit holders to read this book, borrow it, steal it, ask John for a scratched and dented copy, or buy the thing. And this is an important journey. So I really appreciate your taking the time to visit, John.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, Tom. And there's a lot more I could learn from just sitting and listening. So,
two-way street, John. All right.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Enjoy. Bye-bye.